Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood, and we're looking, as we do most weeks at this time, at the worlds of economics and politics. Two guests up today. First, in a few minutes, we'll talk with economist Mark Weisbrot about Argentina's economic crisis of the early 2000s, which was surmounted through a conscious debt default. Is there a lesson here for Greece? And then we'll hear from Madhusree Mukherjee, author of Churchill's Secret War, who'll talk about Indian history, British colonialism, and a horrific instance of famine in 1943, which Britain entirely tolerated. Before that, some comments. Man, is it ever great to see Occupy Wall Street come back to life with the Eastern Spring. Yes, the NYPD is brutal and thuggish, but it's feeling kind of like it did last fall all over again. Political energy wherever you turn. Frequent listeners may recall that I've been very skeptical of the move-your-money fads of the last few years, taking deposits out of big banks and putting them in small, allegedly community banks or credit unions. My argument is that while there may be good consumer reasons, lower fees, friendlier service, to bank small, you're not really doing that much to change the world. Many small banks and credit unions have more money than they know what to do with, and end up lending a lot to the big banks or buying very conventional bonds with their surplus. I spent most of my life writing and broadcasting as a critic, and not much time trying to work out the details of a better world. Sure, I've got my principles, more peaceful, more egalitarian, less alienating, less destructive world. But I often find it difficult to get more detail than that. Besides, I fear that being a critic is far more in tune with my temperament. I should try being more constructive. Here's an attempt. Before I talk about how we might make better credit unions, a few words about what finance does. The classic line is the financial sector exists to mediate between savings and investment. As Keynes said, those are two names for the portion of what we produce that's not consumed. But these functions are done by different people. So, for example, households, mostly rich ones, of course, save a lot of money, and businesses need other people's money to finance their real investments. The role of the markets in funding business investment is greatly exaggerated. Most capital spending is financed internally out of profits. But still, the point should be retained that savings and investment are bound up together. But that's not all the markets do. There are also institutions that organize the ownership and control of productive assets, including, sometimes, governments. Shareholders own the companies they hold stock in. Bondholders pressure governments into austerity in the midst of a fiscal crisis. Venture capitalists guide the startup companies that they finance with a pretty heavy hand. Financial markets allow the rich to own pieces of an entire economy, and with increasing cross-border holdings, that economy can be thought of in global terms. So if we're thinking about changing finance, we also have to think about changing the ownership and governance of the institutions in the real world. What happens, for example, on the other side of the deposit when you move your money to a credit union? Parenthetically, and this is in the sense that you paradoxically sometimes put an important point in parentheses to emphasize it, since the financial system is a system of organizing ownership and control at the heart of ruling class formation, then reforming it is no walk in the woods. We can talk about Wall Street's lobbying power, which is considerable, but when you mess with Wall Street, you're messing with the basis of our social hierarchy. That's why even modest regulations are so difficult. That's not a reason not to try to wrestle with the big financial beast, but there's also another approach, that of, to use a phrase I once read in Left Review, but whose precise origins I can't track down now, that of building guerrilla encampments around capital. One of the strategies cited by practical revolutionaries is building worker co-ops, and the model for those on a large scale is that around Mondragon, a town in the Basque Country in Spain. Before all you ultras out there think I've taken leave of my senses, I'll file the usual reservations in a few minutes, but first a little exposition. Mondragon is a system of cooperative, worker-owned enterprises founded by a priest in the 1950s. It is not a hippie vegan bakery by any means. Annual revenues of the co-ops together is around 15 billion euros. Lines of businesses include appliances, where it all started, auto parts, furniture, construction, architecture, engineering, consulting, retail, and most recently, an electric city car. Mondragon operates globally, with outposts in the Czech Republic, China, Mexico, India, and the U.S., among others. All the cooperatives have a common democratic structure, at least on paper. At the core or summit of the cooperative structure is a credit union, the Caja Laboral Popular, which is where this gets interesting from my point of view. The Caja is owned by the member co-ops who can only bank with it. That could be a prescription for disaster. What's to stop the members from demanding unlimited quantities of free money that would eventually drive the whole thing under? But consistent with what I was saying earlier about finance, the bank is deeply involved in the governance of its member co-ops. As a leader in the 1980s said, the whole thing involves an arabesque of equilibria of power. The Caja also acts as a venture capitalist, financing startup cooperatives, but like our VCs, is heavily involved in the launch. Like our businesses, the co-ops are mostly self-financing and are supposed to be, but members do borrow from the bank to expand into new ventures and such. Now, fairness and critical temperament dictate that I file some objections. The anthropologist Sharon Kazmir published a book in 1996 called The Myth of Mondragon, based on extensive field research in the area. She paints a very critical picture. Among the objections, many cooperative workers feel just as alienated and powerless as their counterparts in capitalist enterprises. Defenders of Mondragon say that's mainly because they have higher expectations. The co-ops can also express a conservative politics. For example, many local reactionaries regarded the co-ops as preferable to socialism, as institutions that comported with the small business ideology of Basque nationalism. Most cooperators resisted the labor and political militancy of the 1970s, when Basque nationalism combined with labor unrest to produce a wave of strikes. But it could be that the cooperators were happier with their situation and didn't feel the need to strike. And besides, it's not clear how relevant this objection is in a world where such militancy has disappeared. As Mondragon's enterprises have expanded abroad, they've hired contract workers who are outside the traditional cooperative structure. And finally, though this is not a point that Kazmir makes, you have to wonder how exportable this model is, given how embedded it is in the relatively insular culture of the Basque country, surrounded as it is by mountains, and inhabited by a small number of people who speak a language unrelated to any other in the world. But I'm going to bracket that set of objections to draw this conclusion. If we're going to talk about remaking the financial system, we should also use that as a way of talking about the institution that it finances. So why not think about organizing credit unions on large scale that exist to finance worker co-ops? It's not clear if this can be done under present legal arrangements, but it's worth investigating. Mondragon is still part of a larger capitalist economy, though it's largely escaped the ill effects of Spain's economic crisis, and so has to operate in competitive markets and in societies in which capitalist mode of thoughts dominate. There's a limit on just how much it can transform. Mondragon is hardly a transition to utopia, or even a comprehensive model of a feasible socialism, but it is a plausible model of how to do things differently. So, invoking the spirit of Marx's praise for Robert Owen's early cooperatives, for those of us living in a market-saturated, polarizing, alienating, unstable, and often horrific society, it offers some hope and a suggestion that we can do things differently. Let's take a musical break, and we'll be back to talk about Argentina. That was the first of three Argentinian dances by the Argentinian composer Alberto Ginastera, a dance of the old herdsman performed by the great Argentinian pianist Martha Argerich. You probably couldn't hear it, but the left hand in that piece plays only the black notes of the piano and the right hand only the white notes. I couldn't hear it either. I read it in Wikipedia. All that Argentinianness was a setup for this segment, an interview with the economist Mark Weisbrot, co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research in Washington, D.C., Mark has made extensive study of the Argentine economic crisis of the early 2000s and the subsequent unorthodox recovery from it, a significant feature of which was a conscious debt default. Does this hold any lessons for Greece and other countries going through the austerity ringer now? Mark says yes. My guru on Greece, frequent guest, Yanis Varoufakis, says no, and I'll try to get him back soon with a response. Here's Mark Weisbrot. Welcome, Mark. You've done a lot of work on the Argentine economic crisis of a little over a decade ago, and its possibility as a model for Greece. First of all, just take us back to the Argentine situation. What drove them into crisis, and what happened?
Well, they had a recession that began in mid-1998, and they tried a similar kind of strategy to what Greece was trying, which is known as an internal devaluation. They had a fixed exchange rate, kind of like similar in some ways to what Greece has in that they have the euro. Argentina didn't have the dollar adopted, but they had their currency, the peso, pegged to the dollar at a one-to-one rate. And so it was a similar problem in the sense that the currency got overvalued. Now, that was just part of their problem, though. They had a recession, and the recession continued to get worse because they were under IMF agreements. And so they agreed to maintain high interest rates in order to keep the fixed exchange rate. If you have high interest rates, you're more likely to be able to keep capital in the country, or at least enough to be able to maintain the exchange rate. They had to borrow a lot in order to do that because they had to borrow dollars to buy up their own currency to maintain the exchange rate. And then so they piled up more debt, and they got caught in kind of a spiral where they got a rising current account deficit or trade deficit. So investors more and more wanted to flee the country, and so they had to raise interest rates even more, and that increased their foreign payments or their current account deficit. So they were in kind of a spiral in that sense. And, of course, the recession got worse from the tightening of both monetary and fiscal policy. I think that's the part that's most similar to Greece.
And they had a currency board arrangement going, which seemed to work for like magic for a little while. But what was that all about?
Well, the currency board was just basically the fixed exchange rate, where they would make sure that, you know, every peso could be exchanged for $1, and that was kind of guaranteed. And also that their money supply would be to some extent, or to a large extent, controlled by, you know, how many dollars come into the country. So in that sense, it was somewhat, not exactly, but somewhat similar to a gold standard. But I think the most important thing is that they were stuck in this situation where they had an overvalued exchange rate, a recession, and they were stuck, or at least were stuck in that situation, and their economy was shrinking. And the only way out in the so-called internal devaluation, the idea was, you have a recession creates enough unemployment, it pushes wages down so much that the economy becomes more competitive internationally, and then it can recover. And that's exactly what they're trying to do with Greece for as long as it remains in the euro. And it didn't work in Argentina, obviously, and we'll get to how they actually did recover. But just to look at Greece for 1 second here, besides the fact that they've lost 16% of GDP, and they're still in recession. The main purpose of the way the internal devaluation is supposed to work is you push what's called your real exchange rate down. So in other words, Greece still has the euro, so their exchange rate is whatever the euro's exchange rate is against other currencies. It can't change as long as they have the euro. But the idea is that's the nominal rate. But the real rate can change if wages fall enough, a unit labor cost fall enough. And so you have measures from the IMF of their actual real exchange rate. In other words, that tells you whether the internal devaluation has been working. And after more than 4 years of recession, their real effective exchange rate is still higher than it was back in 2006. So even on its own terms, and ignoring all the brutality of it and the cuts in the minimum wage and pension cuts and health care and education spending and everything else, it's not working even on its own terms. And that's what happened to Argentina. The same thing was happening to them back at the end of 2001.
And just to clarify the logic of this for the listeners, the devaluation, whether it's of a currency in the conventional sense or through this wage-cutting devaluation in the synthetic sense, the logic is that it's supposed to depress imports and stimulate exports and put the foreign accounts back into balance.
That's right.
And just parenthetically before we move on, what is the obsession that so many economic policymakers have with maintaining the exchange rate? Is it some sort of economic machismo, or is there some material interest? Why this obsession?
Well, actually, economists are not that necessarily in favor of fixed exchange rates. I think at the time of Argentina, there was much more support within the IMF for maintaining these fixed exchange rates. But after you had the collapses in Russia and Brazil and Argentina in the late 90s, you had some pegged exchange rates collapse in the Asian crisis as well around the same time. I think they don't really have a strong bias anymore in the IMF or in the majority of the economics profession in favor of a fixed exchange rate.
Okay, now moving on to the Argentine situation. So finally, all these pressures just accumulated and something broke. So what happened in Argentina?
Well, in Argentina, what broke was they couldn't make their debt payments, and the IMF, it's interesting, you know, back then the IMF had a limited amount of money they could loan. It's not like today, where they have many times the resources they had at that time. So in some sense, Argentina didn't have much of a choice in terms of the default. They couldn't pay anymore. And so they defaulted on their sovereign debt at the end of 2001. And then within a few weeks, they also dropped the pegged exchange rate.
And they also defaulted on their debt to the IMF, which is rather rare, isn't it?
Well, they didn't do that until 2003, and it was in the process of negotiations. They just refused the IMF conditions in September of 2003, so they had a technical default, but the IMF backed down immediately and rolled over their debt. So in a sense, they called the IMF bluff, the first middle-income country to really ever do that. You know, the only countries that had ever defaulted to the IMF prior to that were, you know, failed states like, you know, Iraq or Chad or places like that. And you didn't have a middle-income country do that. And nobody knew what was going to happen at the time. It was very gutsy. But they just weren't going to give in at that point.
Now, working in Argentina's favor was a lot of its debt was in the form of bonds held by individuals, like, you know, Italian dentists and such, were Argentina's creditors. Did that have an impact on the course of events after the default?
Well, not too much. I mean, they did get 80% of their creditors, or at least of the amount of money, was restructured with about a two-thirds haircut in 2005. And there are the holdouts, and then they recently reached an agreement, not all of them, but a big chunk of them also reached an agreement recently. So there's still some holdouts, and they're still causing them trouble in the courts around the world and in the U.S. Congress, where they have a lobby group here. And where the Obama administration just recently caved in a little bit to that lobby group or significantly, and agreed to oppose multilateral loans to Argentina. So they're still fighting, but they've done so well economically that these are really a small price to pay.
So what was the result of this default, and what did Argentina do after that engineered its recovery?
Well, they did have a severe financial collapse, as you would expect, and the banking system collapsed, and it was quite a mess. But the collapse of the economy actually was only for one quarter after, contrary to all predictions in the business press and everywhere else, you know, who were predicting that their troubles were just beginning and they would have years of recession and depression. The economy shrank for just one quarter. Now, it was a big drop. They lost 5% of GDP in that one quarter. But then they recovered, and faster, and in the 6 years of recovery from 2002 to 2008, before the world recession hit, they grew about 63% in terms of GDP, which is the fastest growth in the Western Hemisphere. And it wasn't just, you know, it also had a huge impact on people's lives. They pulled 11 or 12 million people out of poverty within a few years, and in a country of, at that time, about 39 million people. And they restored their pre-crisis level of GDP in about 3 years. And you know, and they continued. They recovered actually after the recession of 2008. So they've grown about over 90% in the last 9 years, and they've reduced poverty by about two thirds, extreme poverty by about two thirds, and that's using, of course, the independent estimates of inflation, not the government's statistics. So on that basis, I mean, it was just no economist that I know has even really tried to deny that was a very successful default.
What were the economic sectors that led the way up?
It was mainly domestic consumption and investment. And that's important, too, because it is written off in the press a lot as a commodities boom. But in fact, it was not an export-led growth experience at all. For the whole recovery from 2002 to 2008, it was only about 12% of the growth, not 12 percentage points of GDP, but just 12% of the total growth, was actually due to exports, and only not even half of that due to commodities. So it wasn't a commodity boom or an export-led growth experience at all. The main thing that happened, and I think that's very important to Europe's experience today, is that they liberated themselves from the pro-cyclical policies, the policies that were shrinking the economy, and they were able to pursue a whole set of heterodox policies which enabled them to grow. And I can go into some of those if you want.
But how do they finance especially the investment side, without access to foreign capital?
Well, you don't need foreign capital for investment. You know, foreign capital is important to have foreign exchange. So in other words, you have to be able to cover your imports and not have a balance of payments crisis. And that they were able to do because they did, in the first 6 months, get a boost from the devaluation. Now, most of that boost was not so much the growth of exports as it was the shrinking of imports, because imports became more expensive and were replaced with domestic production. They also got some billions of dollars came back into the country because everything was cheap. So you got a big investment effect, even more than trade probably. So that combination was enough to make sure they could cover their imports. So the exports were important. I mean, it was important that they had sufficient exports and a sufficient reduction in imports in order to avoid balance of payments crisis. But you have to remember that if you can do that, then everything else is just your own currency, and you can print as much of that as you want, provided you're not running into some kind of inflation constraints. And they did get a burst of inflation from the devaluation in the first few months. It hit as high as 40%, but it was very short, and I think by the end of the year it was already down to 3%.
And they weren't punished at all by being cut out of trade finance or export markets or import markets or anything?
No, that was the threat. If they had defaulted to the IMF and it really defaulted, there was a threat that they could be cut out of everything, because the IMF supposedly has that power and has used it to cut off trade credits altogether. That was the big fear. But that never happened because the IMF backed down. They were cut off mainly from international borrowing, but they didn't need it, because they were running a balance of payments surplus rather soon after the devaluation and default.
I should say I'm speaking with Mark Weisbrot, co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research in Washington. And what's the lesson here for Greece and other peripheral countries? Now, Greece has already experienced, one of the worst collapses in economic history. So they've gone through a lot of pain already. What's the possible lesson from Argentina for them?
I think the lesson is, and I think that the media misses this, is that it should be taken very seriously. They have to consider whether they would be better off getting out of the euro and defaulting on their debt and getting a new start the way Argentina did. Again, they would have an initial crisis, but there's a very good chance, or they're certainly in a better position than Argentina was, to have a very fast recovery and to also, if necessary, borrow from other sources. Argentina didn't have that. They had a net 4% of GDP drained out of the economy in 2002 by the international financial institutions like the IMF and the World Bank demanding their payments. So they had negative help, whereas I think Greece today could borrow from some of the countries that have large foreign exchange reserves if they needed it for balance of payments purposes.
That would be some of the Asian countries, maybe? China?
Yeah. I mean, China has loaned Venezuela two $20 billion installments, and Greece has the advantage of being a small country. They don't need all that much, and probably wouldn't need, it might not need anything if the devaluation works. They also have a, you know, their percentage of exports, their exports as a percentage of the economy is about twice the level of Argentina, so they would have a bigger effect of the devaluation. And so I'm not saying it would be easy or they should just do it, because there are a lot of things to consider. You have to know a lot of detail about how they would handle the financial collapse. But you have to remember that, you know, there have been a lot of these experiences in the last, you know, 100 years or so, and including our Great Depression. And you don't see anything where an economy just collapses and goes to hell, you know, as a result of just a default or devaluation. You can see experiences like the Great Depression where a whole series of policy mistakes are made over years that are worse than what Greece has gone through. And you can see, you know, Russia in 92, but that was, you know, a very different thing too. That was a whole series of policy mistakes or early 90s. But anything worse than what you're looking at Greece didn't happen just from a default or a devaluation or both. I mean, a financial collapse is not the end of your economy. It means that you have a deep, you may have a deep recession. But after that, you know, I mean, you know, once you repair the financial system, you're back to, you should be able to recover fairly quickly.
Well, it's also the case that Greece has not done very well by following orthodoxy.
Well, that's a tough call, and that's why I don't say that, you know, I don't make a recommendation here, because it's kind of like when you make a really bad investment, you know, like you buy stock in something that you think is going to go up, and it goes down, and it goes further down, and you have to decide, you know, when to sell and when to get out. And that's kind of what they've done. They've made a very bad investment. On the other hand, they've lost so much already that you might think they have to, the way, you know, how much more are they going to lose in this sticking with this policy and this investment? And they also have to think about how fast, you know, I mean, economies do eventually recover, and this one will too. But then there's the question of how fast they recover. And that's where I think the argument on the default exit is the strongest, because that's where you're most likely to have a rapid recovery. You can't, it's very hard to foresee that, and the IMF certainly doesn't foresee it. I mean, you know, as I mentioned earlier, Argentina got their pre-crisis level GDP back in 3 years. Greece, if everything goes well, according to IMF plans, it'll be 10 or 12 years or even more.
All right, thanks, Mark.
Thank you, Doug.
That was Mark Weisbrot, co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research in Washington, D.C. You're listening to KPFA and KPFB in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno, and on the web to kpfa.org. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News. Back after a break to discuss Winston Churchill and his secret war in India. Some of India Whiskey by the Brooklyn-based composer Missy Mazzoli. It has nothing in common with the next segment except a word. My guest now is Madhusri Mukherjee, author of Churchill's Secret War, The British Empire and the Ravaging of India During World War II, recently out in paper from Basic Books. The main topic of the book is a 1943 famine in India, which the British government entirely tolerated. But it's also a primer in Indian history for a lot of us who are underread on that important topic. The book is rigorous and well-written, and it deserves a lot of attention. Madhushri Mukherjee. Welcome. Let's just start with a personal tale. How'd you go from science to writing history?
Well, after doing a PhD in physics, and I did a postdoc at Caltech, and after that, frankly, I had trouble finding a job in physics, so I thought I would try some science writing. I ended up as an editor at Scientific American magazine, where it was a wonderful experience because we had to deal with a huge variety of subjects, and I acquired a lot of confidence that I could deal with a large variety of subjects. And at this point, this was about 95, I became interested in an Aboriginal people who live in the Andaman Islands in the Bay of Bengal, which is near India. And these people are hunter-gatherers, and they live on an... There's one group that lives on an island where you still can't approach because they'll shoot you dead with arrows. So I thought that was absolutely wonderful, and I ended up writing a book about these people. It's my first book, the...
Kind of hard to do field work on that,
though. Yes, it is. I did see them from a distance. I didn't want to get close. Yeah, that was The Land of Naked People, my first book. And after I had... that book kind of evolved from being a study of Aboriginal peoples to being a study of how they deal with the real world, and they find it extremely hard to deal with our civilization. But after I had finished that, I figured I understood a lot about indigenous peoples, but I didn't understand anything about the ordinary poor, and I had grown up in India surrounded by poverty while I lived as a middle-class person in relative comfort. We had servants, for instance, who came from the villages and seemed to own absolutely nothing at all, not even a change of clothes. And I always wanted to understand why India was so poor. And the literature that you get on poverty is really impenetrable. At least that was my feeling. So I applied kind of my scientific training to simplify the problem of poverty. I thought, if I study a situation where you have only one dimension, such as food, to study, maybe I'll understand something real about poverty. So this is something physicists do all the time. They take a complex situation and they make a model out of it, and they study the model, and then they figure maybe they understand something about the real system. So I thought, well, a famine is a situation where you have poverty in a single dimension, which is food. You don't worry about education, you don't worry about shelter, you don't worry about anything else other than food. And if I could understand that, maybe I would have understood something about poverty. So there was a famine, not in my history, but in my culture's history, which is I come from Bengal, which is in eastern India, and there was a famine in 1943. And I used to have a neighbor who was very old. I called him grandfather or dadu. And he used to be a civil servant in the British administration during this famine. And he mentioned the famine. He was the first one to mention it to me. And he said something about food being taken away to feed the soldiers and so that the Japanese wouldn't get it. And then he wouldn't say any more. So after I had finished my Indigenous Peoples book, I thought I would study the famine, which meant for me starting to study history from scratch, because I've never had a course in history in my life.
Well, actually, the book, aside from being the story of the famine, is a good overview of Indian history. Fill in a lot of blanks for people who may not be familiar with that. But you open with the history of Bengal and its colonization. To Western mythology, India has been perpetually poor, presumably for some defect in its people. But of course, Bengal was anything but poor before the British arrived, right?
Well, that's right. It was an amazingly successful part. It was the richest part of India. And in fact, a lot of travelers believed it to be at least one of the two or three richest parts of the world at that time. Bengal at the time was exporting food all around India, even to Sri Lanka. It was exporting cottons to all of Europe, silks. It's white cottons especially were very famous, and in fact it is said that Bengal provided the underwear for all of Europe, because that's where it all came from. That's where Europeans started learning to wear underwear, in fact, because you had the soft, absorbent material. The East India Company was trading in, the British East India Company was trading in Bengal cottons, transporting them. But the company...
On presumably rather decent terms. They were not bleeding
right,
the Indians.
Right, exactly. The problem for the East India Company, and in fact for all Western traders, was that places like India and China had no need for any European goods. So whereas, so they had to be paid for in gold, which was coming from South America, in fact, at this point, gold and silver. So you had this kind of a global economy. It's really interesting that far back in the 1700s, where all of this gold and silver acquired in South America was ending up in India and China to pay for things like cotton, silk, tea, and other habits, and sugar and other habits that the Europeans were acquiring. And when the East India Company ended up actually in battle, fighting the local Indian Nawab or ruler in battle and defeating them, this situation completely changed. So instead of having to transport silver and gold to India, what happened was that the East India Company started collecting taxes, massive quantities of taxes. And with these taxes, they bought all of the goods that they would sell in Europe to make a profit. So they didn't actually have to bring anything into India. They were just simply taking stuff out. So in the first, within the first 10 years of the Battle of Plassey, which was in 1757, when the East India Company defeated the local Indian prince, the East India Company was taking out three times more goods and money, silver, gold, diamonds, three times more than it was putting into India.
And they bled it dry, really, right?
That's right. Right, in 1770, there was a massive famine in Bengal, which killed one-third of the people. That's about 10 million people. And it was precipitated by drought. But in normal years, the people would have had savings or grain in the home to tide over a bad year of harvest, and they had no savings at all. People were even reportedly selling their children to pay these massive taxes that the East India Company was demanding, which was at a far higher scale than had ever been demanded before.
And then British rule spread westward from Bengal to the rest of India.
That's right. Bengal provided the financing for the East India Company to conquer the rest of India.
And it was kind of a privatized colonization.
Well, exactly, yes.
It was. What role was the British government in London playing?
They were supporting the East India Company with troops when necessary and with money when necessary. And in return, they were getting a large amount of money from the East India Company. What happened in 1857 was that there was a massive rebellion in India. Possibly 100,000 people died. It was a very bloody rebellion. And to suppress that rebellion, Britain sent troops at the cost of something like £50 million. And after the Indians had been defeated, that amount was added to the debt that India owed to the British Empire at this point.
In the British financial mind, India had to be responsible for its own colonization.
Well, yes, it was.
Financially responsible.
Financially, it always was responsible for its own colonization. Yes, exactly.
This is what made the British so good at finance, I guess. We need to step forward several decades to the figure of Churchill, who is revered in many circles, but was actually quite monstrous in many ways. The picture you paint of Churchill is a man of, as you said, it felt lonely without a war, just a man driven by war and an intense contempt for the lower orders of humankind.
Well, he was a product of the Victorian era. He was an aristocrat, and
A long line of them.
He had ancestors who were. One of the Duke of Blenheim was one of his ancestors who won a massive victory against the Germans in Blenheim and gained a palace as a result. And Churchill was born in this palace, and this palace has all kinds of artwork that recall militarism. And he describes actually watching the pageant at the coronation of Queen Victoria and being completely thrilled by it. At that time, war was very romantic. In fact, I think he was really dismayed by World War I and how grotesque it was, because it damaged his very romantic notions of, you know, heroic warfare.
Well, and he's disappointed that it was supposed to be the war that ended all wars, right? So there would be no future venue for his heroism.
Yeah, so when he's at Sandhurst learning to be a cavalryman, he says things like, we would all hope for at least an uprising in India so we could all march around and, you know, get medals and a lot of promotion very young, like Robert Clive did. General Robert Clive was the one who won the prize of India at the Battle of Plassey.
And he also was, he's famous for this quote about, he couldn't understand the squeamishness about using poison gas on uncivilized
against the
tribes.
Yeah. Yes, exactly. Yes, he was fairly bloodthirsty. And in fact, when World War I broke out, he wrote to his wife about how thrilled he was. He was on top of the world. And he said, I know this is not the way I should be, but that's the way I am, essentially. And when World War II broke out, he was clearly recognized by everyone around him as the one person who would actually have a good time taking charge of this horrible war. He wanted to be prime minister. And everybody recognized that he had these kind of warlike qualities that would serve Britain well, at least, in times of war.
And what role did India play in the war?
Well, India, as a colony, was always expected to help Britain out in times of economic need. And this was total war. It was a time when massive amounts of resources were expended on fighting Hitler. So India... the entire economy was turned over to war production. So its entire production of cement, steel, timber, railway tracks, railway engines, everything was requisitioned for the war effort. And this had an immense effect on the Indian economy because all of this was being paid for by paper money. So at the start of the war, Britain and India reached kind of a quote-unquote agreement by which India would pay for all of these war supplies, and Britain would, after the war, pay back that part which could be construed as not being in India's interest. So India had 5 to 7 divisions fighting in the Middle East. So these things Britain would pay back later.
And in violation of the laws of nature, now the financial relations have been reversed, and India was running
the
up
course
a big surplus.
Of the war,
Britain was owing... ended up owing India money.
That's right. So after the war was over, Britain would owe India a lot of money. And it was a lot more than the British had anticipated. It would end up being about £1 billion that Britain would owe India after the war. And this ended up being a huge source of angst to Churchill. He was absolutely furious that this colony, which is supposed to owe money to Britain, it had always, for 200 years, owed money to Britain, whether for paying pension, well, for a huge number of expenses that Britain imposed upon India. But for the first time, this was reversed, that Britain would actually owe India money. And this was made Churchill very angry with Indians at a time when Indians could ill afford his anger.
I'm speaking with Modusri Mukherjee, who is the author of Churchill's Secret War, The British Empire and the Ravaging of India During World War II, out in paperback from Basic Books.
And now this famine of 1943, which is the centerpiece of the book. Famines historically have been a complicated mix of price and physical availability of food. What led to this famine in 43?
Well, it was largely this massive inflation. During the course of the war, India was paying for this massive war expenditure, but it was paying with paper money. So the inflation just went through the roof. And at one point in late 1942, the government of India anticipated food shortages in India because India also had a massive army that it was feeding, about 2 million people. And there were other war-related factors. The Japanese were at the border. They had cut off imports of rice into India. So at a time when India was lacking its normal imports of rice, India was also being forced to export rice for the war effort, and Churchill was personally responsible for insisting that India continue to export rice even after it faced massive shortages of its own. Well, in late 1942, the Indian government asked for imports of about 500 to 600,000 tons of wheat to feed the army, and Churchill refused because he wanted to use the ships that were available in order to build up a stockpile for Britain to use during and after the war, and we can talk about that later. Well, what happened was that facing a food shortage, having to feed the army, the local authorities panicked, and they sent out agents to buy up all the food available at any price. And since the government was printing paper money, they could pay any price. So what happened was that in February 1943, the price of rice just simply went through the roof. It was 3 to 4 or 5 times even what it used to be a few months earlier. And a famine set into India because of the economy freezing up completely and this huge flood of paper money just sending all prices up.
So at this time, was India producing food that people just couldn't afford to buy?
Yes, that was part of it. You know, people who could, anyone could see, anyone who was reading the papers could see that a famine was coming for at least a year ahead. So hoarders started stockpiling wheat. And this is a normal sort of, I don't want to excuse it as moral, it's not moral, but it's a normal reaction when you, in the face of rising prices, that people start stockpiling either to protect their families or to make a profit later. Because later, you know the prices are going to rise, you know if you can sell it later, you'll make money. So people had been stockpiling rice, and in fact, the government was in fact itself stockpiling rice and wheat to feed the army. So the market just froze. There wasn't anything available on the market, even if you had the money at this point.
And the reaction of the British government was, let it happen.
Yes, basically that was it. The priority of the British government in India was to continue the war effort. So as long as they could feed the army, they were all right. In fact, at one point when the British government decides to go up and buy up all of the available wheat and rice, you have local officials saying, we know that lots of people are going to die, but we have no other option if we are to keep the war effort going.
And at this time, Britain was stockpiling food for a war that would not end for another 2 years. And of course, they had no way of knowing that. It could have gone on who knows how long, but they were stockpiling food.
Well, at this point, say, the war had turned. I mean, the U.S. was in the war, and 1943, in the middle of 1943, you have Britain had a was importing huge quantities of grain and other materials from Canada and the United States. And all of this was coming by ships over the Atlantic. And in 1941, there was a huge loss of ships to German U-boats. But in the spring of 1943, the situation was relieved because of American ship production, which was massive, and because the U-boat war was suddenly started to be won because finally bombers were assigned to these convoys and they started to take out the U-boats. So in 1943, what Britain had perceived as a shipping crisis completely eased and gave way to what some historians call a shipping glut, because the U.S. was producing ships at such a massive rate. In 1 month alone, it produced more than 1.5 million tons of shipping.
Some of that not far from where we sit. At the Brooklyn Navy Yard. So at this point then, Britain, the food was available and the means of transport were available to relieve
exactly.
the Indian famine.
Wheat was available in Australia. And in fact, once it became known that India was suffering a famine, all of the dominions, Australia, New Zealand, South Africa, offered help. In fact, the United States offered help. And for reasons that are not completely clear, Churchill and his war cabinet turned down all of these offers of help. They felt that India was part of the British Empire and they would not tolerate any offers of help from the United States, which they were afraid was going to take over the world order after the World War was finished.
And then Churchill and his colleagues were at the same time blaming the Indian capacity to breed like rabbits, right, for the problem.
That's right. So you have several war cabinet meetings in which the Secretary of State for India asks for help to stave off the famine. In particular, there's a meeting on August 4th, 1943, at the height of the famine, when the war cabinet refuses to schedule any relief at all for Indian famine. And it's amazing because in the months of September and October, you have 10 ships loading in Australia with food, wheat and wheat flour and other food. And not one of them goes to India. They go to a stockpile that's being built up in the Mediterranean to feed Europe after it is liberated. Later in the year, when the question came up again and again of sending relief for Indian famine, the War Cabinet did schedule the shipments of barley and 50,000 or maybe 80,000 tons of wheat for India, but it was a drop in the ocean because the Indian government had asked for at least 500,000 tons of wheat, and barley was not something that the famine victims could digest. It was simply useless for the famine relief. But it's interesting here because wheat was considered by the War Cabinet to be an upper-class food, and it had to be reserved for Europeans, whereas barley, which was grown in the Middle East, could be transferred back to India on all the ships that were going back empty towards Australia. But barley was useless. So the Indian famine actually came to an end in December, January, when Indians harvested their own rice crop for...
I would encourage people to get the book for just more details on the famine, but I do want to touch, before we finish, on some events late in the story when that really laid the groundwork for a lot of troubles in the region today, the partition of into India, Pakistan, Bangladesh, and then also the fomenting of Hindu-Muslim violence. So could you talk some about how that fit into British imperial strategy and, you know, what the heritage of that has been?
Well, British imperial strategy in India had always been to divide and rule. And there had been efforts to sort of split up the Hindus and the Muslims.
People had been living together in harmony.
For several hundred years, 800 years, Hindus and Muslims had lived together in relative harmony. They shared a lot of cultural practices. They still do. And sometimes they would worship at the same shrines. So in India, you have a synthesis of Sufism, which is one of the sects of Islam, and the Hindu god Krishna, who is, they both believe in love as an approach to God. And in India, you had a kind of a mixed religion, which was Muslim and Hindu at the same time. You've had singers who spoke of both Hindu and Muslim figures. So you had a lot of harmony. But, of course, whenever you have a fission, you always have a way to split the two people. And the way the British government did this was starting in early 1900 in Bengal, which is, again, where this famine happened. There was a very powerful anti-British movement. And in order to split up this movement, the British government of the time ordered a split in the entire state, so that the Muslims who were in the east, in what is now Bangladesh, would be split from the Hindus in what is now West Bengal in India. So this split was eventually annulled, but you can see the strategy already. Muslims were required to vote only for Muslims. Hindus could not vote for Muslims. So these were strategies that actually ended up making Muslims and Hindus look to different leaders for their communities, because they weren't able to, weren't even allowed to vote for a figure who stood for unity. Churchill was very much part of this mold. In fact, he even said that the Hindu-Muslim divide is the bulwark of British rule in India. And he did all he could to increase this divide. In fact, when a Muslim leader, Jinnah, first spoke of the need for a Muslim nation of Pakistan, Churchill hailed it as a sign of the new self-assertiveness of Muslims in India. He thought it was a good thing. Because,
and then perversely, they could look at any conflict as proof of the need for British rule, because these people were incapable.
Well, exactly. So Churchill's understanding of Pax Britannica was that India had always been riven by rivalries and wars, and that the British had brought peace. That was his understanding of
which is a total
the
invention.
British. Exactly. This was the peace of the graveyard. So during World War II, you have Jinnah being encouraged by Churchill at every step. Jinnah saying that he will support the war effort if he is allowed to be the sole spokesperson for Muslims, which he never was. Before the war, his Muslim League party got 5% of the Muslim vote. So that's really significant. You have Muslims actually having a separate vote, and they're allowed to vote only for Muslims, but Jinnah's getting only 5%. During the war, with all of the nationalist Indian leaders in prison, such as Gandhi and Nehru, spent almost the entire war in prison. Jinnah is the only person, only political figure in India allowed to have a stage, and he is hammering through his idea of Pakistan. So by the time the war is over...
And Gandhi and Nehru, secular nationalists...
Exactly.
...who didn't want any part of this internal
conflict. No, they did, certainly didn't want to split Hindus and Muslims. They were exactly the opposite. They saw this British strategy and they did their best to fight it. But during the war, because Jinnah had the exclusive Indian political stage, he was able to persuade Muslims that Pakistan would be a good idea, so that after the war, when there was another vote in 1946, the Muslim League, which had gotten only 5% of the Muslim vote before the war, got 75%. So this was essentially a mandate for Pakistan. He had won over the Muslims to his viewpoint. And that was, the war was really what made the splitting of India possible. And the war and British policy.
And we still live with this conflict today.
Yes, it's horrible. Two nuclear armed powers who, yes, have a lot of hostility to one another. It's
and then, of course,
sad.
Internally within India, we see these bouts of sectarian violence, too.
Exactly, yes. There's been... India, the Hindu nationalists were a product, again, of this kind of division, you know, divide and rule. Gandhi gave his life for it. Gandhi was regarded by Hindus as having betrayed Hindus, by a lot of Hindus as having betrayed Hindus, because he always spoke for unity between Hindus and Muslims, and he was assassinated in 1948 because of that by a Hindu fanatic.
British imperialism has a lot to answer for. Thank you very much.
That was Manasri Mukherjee, author of Churchill's Secret War, which came out in paperback from Basic Books a few months ago. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with this, some of Wish, by the German DJ and techno musician Ellen Aline. Till next week, bye.
Need a planet without cars and wars. No wars, no cars, no wars, no cars. I wish it could be true.